Hi, this is Paula Moreau, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
Now don't let go.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Shannon Wurst? Y'all like Shannon? From Fayetteville, Arkansas, award-winning singer-songwriter Shannon Wurst has firmly established herself at the intersection of everyman folk and Americana, rooted in the traditions of Casey Chambers, Alison Krauss, and Dolly Parton. She has CDs for sale after the show, and more can be found at shannonwurst.com. All right, well, welcome to Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. We are on location at the Art Center of the Ozarks in the northwest corner of Arkansas in beautiful downtown Springdale. Tales from the South is presented by Temino's Publishing Company and the Midnight Muse Writing Workshops, and tonight's show is brought to you in part by support from the Arkansas Arts Council's Arts on Tour program, and I'm your host, Paula Martin Morell. And what do y'all think about our set back here? Y'all like our set? These Delta screen doors with mixed media portraiture by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection and are for sale. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. Our listeners can find out more about these pieces and V.L. at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight, our storytellers are all from Northwest Arkansas and all grapple in one way or another with communication. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Vicki Taylor Penny's grandmother has an interesting choice of words, and we'll end the night with Roger Shoffit and a key word. But let's start the night here at Tales from the South with Jane Ellen Quinn, where oral communication ends in Voice of the Heart.
Come now, it won't be long. My gloves tightly grip the steering wheel as my eyes strain to see the boundaries of the entry into the nursing home. Freezing snow chunks pelts against my car. January in Wisconsin. The click, 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 click of the windshield wipers match the beating of my heart. Did I get here in time? I cautiously creep up the long, slippery driveway. Ice and snow smother the sound of my tires. The setting sun leaves behind a coal black sky. The north wind whips at my face as I hurry out of the car and race for the driveway, slipping and sliding, praying not to fall. I'd forgotten how harsh and unforgiving the winters in Wisconsin can be. The metal door slams behind me with a loud thud, pushing me into a stark vestibule. A plump nurse in a sterile white uniform sits at a round reception desk, placed directly in the middle of the vestibule. She glances up and distantly asks, "Are you her daughter?" I nod. "It won't be long now," she says flatly. "You can go in her room. It's down the hall on the right." Mother has no name, just another aging body in a sea of bodies. I race to her room at the end of the barren hall. The pungent odors of disinfectant mixed with urine permeate my nostrils. I unconsciously tiptoe into her room, which makes me smile. Why am I tiptoeing when I want her to know that I'm here to be with her? The silence in the room is overwhelming. "Hello, sweet love. It's Janie. I've missed you. I'm so glad to be here with you." I gaze into her crystal blue eyes and search for recognition, hoping against hope that maybe today she will look at me and say, "I've missed you too, sweetheart." How I miss her calling me sweetheart. Deep loneliness fills my soul. Her breathing is labored and sporadic. A rattle has started in her chest, and she labors for each breath. The sound reminds me of a toy with which a baby plays. The nurse is right. It won't be long now. My eyes scan her body. Tiny, frail, mere bones thinly covered by stretched skin. Her color is so pale that she melts into the white sheets on her narrow bed, a bed held together by steel sides that slide up and down, safety slides, like an infant's crib. Her body makes no movements. She lies as still as a mummy in a tomb, yet life is still breathing within her. "Your mother has a deterioration of the gray matter," the doctors told us in the early stages of her forgetfulness. I knew something was wrong the day she stuck her hand down the garbage disposal to retrieve a spoon that had fallen inside. Only she had forgotten she had left it running. Blessed by the angels, she suffered only minor cuts. Years later, her diagnosis was given the formal name of Alzheimer's disease. I look down at the small woman I have loved for 52 years and lovingly caress her sweet face. I desperately search her gazed eyes for recognition. Nothing. I softly brush a kiss on her pale lips. "Mama, it's Janie. Can you hear me? Do you know that I'm here?" Her eyes stare into open space, zoning, as my children would say. She's asleep with her eyes open. Only emptiness, deep emptiness in her once sparkling blue eyes, seeing but not knowing. Years of dammed up tears flood my cheeks, making my nose run. Tears stream down my face and onto my neck, soaking the collar of my blouse. I can see her, but I can't reach her. It's as if she's encased in a gray balloon of fog. She's here, but she's gone. Weeping as a child, I wipe my dripping nose on my sleeve. Silence hangs suspended in the room. I quietly sit at the side of her bed and gently take her cold, thin hand into mine. Her hand into my hand. Mother and daughter, hands entwined through years of joy and years of pain. My finger traces the patterns her veins create. They look like winding pathways, wandering aimlessly. "I've come to read to you, sweet love." I pick up my Bible and begin to read the Psalms. I start with one I know she'll recognize. It was always her favorite. Slowly, distinctly, I pronounce the words, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." With determination, I decide to try something with Mama I've been contemplating for a long time. "Mama, do you like this psalm? If you don't like it, blink once for no. And if you do like it, blink twice for yes." I wait hopefully, holding my breath. Silence, blankness, the same as before. I continue to read the Psalms, trusting God will allow his holy word to enter into her clouded mind. Hours pass. I rise, stretch my aching back, and walk to the window. Snow is falling and swirling in the wild wind. Suddenly, I catch movement out of the corner of my eye and turn to notice Mama has turned her head to follow my movements. Excitedly, I rush back to her bed. I have to try one more time. Mama, it's Janie. If you know me, Mama, blink twice for yes. Hopefully. Again, I wait. Blankness. Slowly, I lower my tired body into the chair next to her bed. Together, mother and daughter, in silence, we rest side by side, waiting, always waiting, always silence, allowing the voices of our hearts to speak to each other through silent words of love. Her breathing becomes shallow, her chest hardly rising and falling. I know our time is coming to a close. I have to tell her one more time that I love her. I have to say goodbye. I have to tell her to go and be with Jesus. But how? What does a daughter tell a mother? My sisters arrive to sit with me. In silence, we wait and we watch. Her breathing becomes fainter. It is time for us to say goodbye. Standing to reach over the steel rails, I place my damp cheek against Mama's ashen gray cheek and whisper with love, Mama, your daughters are all here. We are doing just fine. Now it's time for you to rest. Close your eyes. Oh, sweet love, rest. We'll be fine. We love you so much. It's time to go home and be with Jesus. Your dad and mother are waiting for you. Your twin sister Jane is waiting to hug you. Go, dear love. It's time to go home, home to Jesus. Slowly her head turns and our eyes meet. Her sweet blue eyes entwine with my hazel brown, and miraculously, she blinks twice. Did it really happen? Did I imagine it? Did I want it so badly that my mind played tricks on me? My body begins to shake and my legs won't hold me. I grab the bed rails and lower myself into my chair. I again look lovingly into her eyes, still blue, still Mama. And she looks back into mine and blinks twice. Tears escape from both our eyes. No words, no sound, sweet silence. The voices of our hearts speak words of love to each other, words of love so powerful that I think the whole nursing home can hear them. I sit like a marble statue, hardly breathing. Only my heart-rent sobs can be heard in the room. Slowly, her breathing comes in short spurts, then grows fainter, and then silent. I know she's gone. Gone home. Gone home to be with grandfather and grandmother. Home with her twin sister. Home with Jesus. Her fight is over. She is finally free. Free of this earthly body and long suffering. God has called her home to his heart. Peace fills my heart. We sisters stand, embrace, say a prayer together for the loss of a mother, and allow our sorrow to be laced with silent peace. We turn and walk down the musty hallway to the nurse's station to let her know mother has gone. Together, we sisters will start the burial process. I slowly walk to my car. The snow has stopped, and a Wisconsin azure blue has filled the sky. Yes, I think, a blue to match mother's eyes. And the voice of my heart whispers in the silence of the crisp air, I will always love you, Mama.
Jane Ellen Quinn has been married 55 years and is the mother of three and grandmother of eight. Her mother suffered with Alzheimer's disease for 15 years before she went to heaven. Born in Green Bay, Wisconsin, Jane is an avid Packer fan. Next on Tales from the South, it's Vicky Penny's grandmother's interesting choice of words that give away her secret in A Southern Dance.
The firm knock sounded from the back door. My grandmother rose deliberately from her seat and smoothed her dress. It was one of her Sunday best, and, as such, to be presented with all the consideration and deliberation that a Protestant day of repentance demanded. Only this wasn't a Sunday, nor was it a Wednesday night where an important business meeting at the church may have required her attendance. I glanced at the enameled black gas cookstove. No chicken and dumplings, so no one we knew had died or passed, a term she often reminded me to use when referring to the deceased. At my ripe old age of 9, I was grateful to have passed math and considered the topic dead, so I often confused the condition of death with my paltry attempts at higher education. In her heart, I knew from even that youthful time that she worried about my future. How was I to find a good man when my attention span, or my lack thereof, did not allow the diligence necessary to master the domestic arts, the skills her generation deemed essential for a girl to become a lady? Instead, I learned to stack wood on her carport near the back door. It was important to do it strategically, leaving gaps now and then as to slide the barrel of my brother's pellet gun into and shoot the insurgents found on the other side of the fortification, mostly the neighbor's dogs. Even my grandmother appreciated the way the canines ran from her garden, yelping, tails tucked and ears on full alert from the shock and sting, all from one well-placed shot to the hindquarters. My grandmother's house was the center of family life. It was a white, painted, clapboard house built in the 1930s. The roof sloped upward dramatically on all sides, with its scalloped shingles gathering high in the center around a fractured red brick chimney. It sat on a raised foundation with hardwood floors throughout, and in acknowledging its age, the rooms dipped and rolled slightly, grumbling like the arthritic elderly when walked upon. In her cozy home, everyone was welcome, period. A typical evening would find my Uncle David and Uncle Gene discussing the day's events over a couple of glasses of my grandmother's iced tea. Real Southern tea, the color of dark Cairo and about as sweet. Now, Uncle David was my aunt's first husband, and Uncle Gene her third. They had become good friends. And when Gladys arrived with her girlfriend, no one questioned her faith or final eternal destination. Two more plates were simply set at the table. On those days that called for a celebration, sawhorses would be dusted off and moved into the front room. Large sheets of plyboard would then be placed across and covered with white sheets. In the kitchen, Grandma was in charge. The other women folk would be allowed to assist only in the mundane tasks such as chopping onions, peeling potatoes, or boiling corn. The secrets of the family recipes would remain with the matron of the house as she moved seamlessly from glazing ham to cornbread dressing with copious amounts of sage to chocolate pie. The doling out of plates would begin in the order of age, the youngest being served first. Then the children would be seated at a folding card table, far enough from the adults as to not be a distraction, but close enough to hear the stories. Storytelling has always been a way of life for my family. The adults continually had one going around, and the kids' table was considered the training ground. By the time we were losing interest in playing go fish with the cousins, children were expected to tell a few good ones. If not, you were taught to play crazy eights and sent back to the kids' table until voting age. And my grandmother would never allow alcohol to pass her lips, except in the case of illness. She would never allow alcohol to enter her home, and by no means should her family ever enter that house of sin called a liquor store. Plenty did, in spite of her wishes. They were relegated to drinking on the carport. I would sit quietly behind the black screen door to hear the history of the family from the slightly inebriated. It was much more colorful and informative than the historical fiction spoken by the others. However, she did keep a bottle of Jack Daniel's whiskey on the shelf for medicinal purposes. It was her one-stop pharmacy. Got the flu? A hot toddy was in order. A cough? Jack, lemon juice, and honey would do the trick. That bottle kept the family healthy through the cold, hard winter. It amazed me how the whiskey would never seem to tap out. Although it was used frequently, it sat perpetually half full, residing in its assigned place high on the shelf. By strict protocol, no family member could provide it. How she acquired it was to puzzle me for many years. Today, though, no one was sick, and no special celebrations were scheduled. It was just Grandma and me on a warm fall afternoon and that knock at the door. I stood behind her as she confidently pulled it open. Through the screen, I recognized Bill Blakely, dressed in his full sheriff ensemble. He normally would have just opened the screen and walked in. It was the understood practice at her house, and I had seen him do it many times before. This time, though, something stopped him. "Hello, Mr. Blakely," Grandma said. "How is your wife?" "Mr. Blakely? She always called him Bill." "This must be serious," I thought. "She's fine, thank you," he replied. "But she asked that I bring you a gift." He pulled a long tan paper bag from behind his back. My grandmother pushed the screen door open and he gently handed it to her. "Why, thank you," she said, smiling. He remained outside as she rushed back to the kitchen, placed the bag on a cabinet, and quickly returned with a homemade pound cake I had missed in my preliminary scan of the kitchen. "And I have a little something for her," she said, and as Mr. Blakely accepted the gift, I drifted back to the paper sack. I looked in the bag and saw what I suspected, the clear, slim glass bottle with the distinctive black label, a new bottle of Jack Daniel's. She closed the door and walked up behind me. Cautiously, she reminded me of the dangers of alcohol. But she also reminded me of a Southern code, a dance that all good neighbors know, that although she would never excuse the purchase of alcohol, she could forgive the thoughtful gifts from neighbors.
Vicki Taylor Penny and her family live in Northwest Arkansas, where she enjoys sharing stories with her family and friends. In our final story of the night here at Tales from the South, one word and Roger Shoffett is sold in Das Boot.
Albert Einstein once said, "We all know that light travels faster than time. That's why certain people seem bright until you hear them." One morning, about 30 years ago, I received a call from my optometrist. "Hey, Roger, I had a bright idea. How would you like to have a free boat?" Free is the key word here. Before hearing any more, I snapped at the chance like a tick on a shaved dog. A lot of his bright ideas in the past had turned out to be cerebral flatulence. But this sounded too good to be true. "There's one slight problem," he said. "I don't have a trailer hitch. The boat's down in Huntsville. And I'd like you to take me down there. We can pick it up and take it directly to your house." It all seemed too good to be true. I'd always wanted a boat of my own. That afternoon, I picked up the dock and we headed south to Old Alabama. It's a town located just near the outskirts of Huntsville, kind of a shadow of a town. Doc didn't talk much on the way down. He didn't say anything. It seemed to be something weighing on his mind. Since he wasn't exactly sure where the boat was parked, he asked me to slow down as we approached Old Alabama. It was at this point that I began to ask him information about the boat and why he was giving it to me, since it was at someone else's house. "Well," he said in the long drawl, "I sold this guy the boat about a year ago, but he never paid me for it." so you might say we're repossessing it. Does he know what we're doing? I inquired. Nope. Here it is. He pointed at a hidden shack hidden in the trees. I think at least that's it. We turned my truck around on the highway and backed into the rutted drive that led up to a broken-down trailer. As soon as we pulled up, a couple of junkyard dogs emerged from under the porch, snarling and barking at us. Doc walked up to the tattered screen door and knocked several times, then peeked in the window. Finally, he shrugged and signaled me to follow him. Judging from the surroundings, the guy was nowhere to be seen, and he was certainly no landscape artist. That's when I found out he was a nighttime eviscerator at Tyson Plant, which wasn't very reassuring. Thankfully, nobody was home, so we decided to work quickly and get the hell out of Dodge. We wove our way through the old appliances on the front porch, avoiding the dogs, and found the boat hidden under a couple of sheets of tin. I returned to the truck and backed it around to the boat while Doc chased four chickens and a goat out of the craft. The tires on the trailer looked roadworthy, but needed air, so as quick as NASCAR crew, we pumped up the tires. Next, we pulled up all the beer cans, tackle boxes, rods, and wildlife that were left littering the bottom of the boat. Within seconds, we fled the scene, boat in tow. On the drive back to Beaver, Doc kept looking back nervously over his shoulder until we crossed the Madison County line. At first, I thought he was concerned about the tires on the trailer or the occasional chicken nest that blew out as we sped down the highway. It was only when we arrived at my house that he confessed that he was actually looking back to make sure that Bubba or the Madison County Sheriff weren't following us. As we unhooked the trailer, I noticed Doc walking around looking at the boat and mumbling to himself. It was only when I stopped what I was doing and listened closely that I could hear him saying, "Yeah, yeah, yeah, this is it. This is it." When I asked him what was wrong, he told me that about halfway home, he started wondering if we'd grabbed the wrong boat. After further investigation, he assured me that we had the right boat. Later that evening, he called me to let me know that he had the title and that neither Bubba or the sheriff would be paying us a visit, at least as far as he knew. The free boat was what you'd call a fixer-upper, from the waiting-to-pop tires to the dead battery. The first time I tried to start the thing, I discovered the key to the boat was missing. So I tried pulling the pull crank, but the rope broke. About $200 later, I put the boat in the water for my maiden voyage, and about a 20-minute ride down the river, the motor began to cough and sputter. Next, we noticed the floor in the boat was filling with water. Fortunately, we made it back to the boat ramp just before the water started spilling in on the sides of the boat. That was the last time I put that thing in the water. I call it a thing because that's what my bride called it. She only used the name in the form of a question like, "When are you going to fix this thing?" or "When are you going to get rid of this thing?" Eventually, several years later, as it sat in our driveway, the opportunity arose to liquidate said asset. The neighbor and his buddy drove by one afternoon and asked me what I'd take for the boat. Before my bride could give it away, I said, $2. They jumped on it like a dog on a piece of bacon. I had to laugh as one of the tires went flat before he made it down the road to his house. The good news was that the eyesore was out of our driveway. My bride couldn't pester me about it anymore. However, the bad news was that it just moved down the street from us, and my wife still had to see it every day on the way to work. Many years later, after I retired and sold my business, I finally bought a brand new fishing boat of my own, and at last, my dream of owning a boat was realized.
Roger Shoffitt is from Beaver, Arkansas. He is happily retired and spends his time fishing, gardening, beekeeping, and painting. He lives with his bride of 38 years and their two dogs. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Mm-hmm. Thank you to all of our writers. Thank you to our live audience here at the Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale, Arkansas. Thank you to AQ Chicken House for providing tonight's dinner. And thank you to ULR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by Temenos Publishing Company and the Midnight Muse Writing Workshops. Additional support provided by the Writers Colony at Dairy Hollow, ULR's Department of Rhetoric and Writing, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Arkansas Arts Council, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. We are open for submissions from all Southerners. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
We're going to do a song, Hear You Here, called Wiley Post. As you can probably guess, it's about Mr. Wiley Post. Wiley was the first person to fly all the way around the world. He had just one eye, and he flew in a plane called Winnie Mae. So we're going to dedicate this to Wiley Post. My first love was blue.
Brighter accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast in Little Rock. More at robinwoodbnb.com. And the Baker House Bed and Breakfast in North Little Rock. More at bakerhousenlr.com. Live sound and studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio in North Little Rock. More at infraredstudioproductions.com. You too can experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. We're now traveling throughout Arkansas and the South, bringing Tales to your community. Details on hosting a live show, our schedule, and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern-style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week on Tales from the South.